Return to Camp Blood, Episode 23, The Mists of Crystal Lake. This episode is brought to you by Friday the 13th Franchise.com.
This is cursed. Jason's alive. He killed my friend, now he's coming for me.
He's got a death curse.
Jason's a legend.
I'm Mrs. Warren, an old friend of the Christies.
Jason belongs in hell.
You're doomed if you stay here.
Never come back again.
You see, Jason was my son, and today is his birthday.
Welcome to another episode of Return to Camp Blood. I'm your host, Chris, joined by my fellow counselors, E.
What's up, y'all?
Eric.
What's up, everybody?
And Oz.
What's up, man?
All right, so this is a very, very special episode. It's taken us working through a lot of technical difficulties to get here, but we finally have arrived. So back on episode 11, we had first Jason himself, Ari Lehman, on. And tonight, I'm actually pleased to say that we have joining us the first final girl and lady of the lake herself, Adrian King. How you doing tonight, Adrian?
I'm doing great. Despite our technical challenges.
It happens. This seems to happen like every time we
it's getting to be a staple every time, on the show.
Is it the curse of the lake?
I think it might be.
It could be. Mama Voorhees curse.
We had similar problems with Ari. Actually, we had to reschedule him for a week later, too.
Yeah.
I see a pattern here.
He said the same thing. It was the curse of Jason.
Yes, he did.
Great minds, huh? Ari's a character. I bet you had a great time with him.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was great. He's a great guy. Great guy.
We're both going to be together this November 13th. Weekend coming up in Portland, Oregon at the Living Dead Convention, if any of your listeners happen to be out in Oregon way.
Nice.
So tell me now, where are all of you guys in the same location? You're all in different places.
Different places.
Yeah, I'm in Virginia. E is in North Carolina. Oz is in Kentucky. And Eric is in Indiana. So we're all over the place.
And who am I talking to, Chris?
Yes, I am the main guy.
You're the main guy. Chris, yeah. And where are you?
I'm in Virginia.
You're in Virginia. Okay, I kind of just want to get a handle on it.
Yeah, Chris is our head counselor.
Leading lady, if you will.
Well, how did you all meet? Through Friday the 13th or through Harp or...
Actually, no, the three of us, me, E, and Eric, we were all in the military together years and years ago. We were all in the Air Force, and we used to watch Friday the 13th movies in my dorm room. And actually, it's a funny story how we got Oz. One night, me and Eric, we had to cancel an episode, and we were just kind of, talking in one of the groups, and Oz was like, hey, I'd like to, be on this episode that you guys are talking about. And I was like, well, we just canceled it. But we brought him on and started talking. I'm like, man, you really know a lot. So we invite him to be a co-host. So that's how we got together.
That's awesome, though. That's really evolving your program to the best.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of the media person. I'm the one who reaches out to and tries to get, guests. I'm the one you were talking to on Facebook.
Did a great job, by the way, Oz.
I appreciate that. And actually, real quick, before we get away from Scarefest, I just want to, the first time I met you was at Scarefest. I think it was 2 years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago,
right.
When you were there.
Yeah. With Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo was there, yes. Yes, they had the Mystery Machine. It was great.
Danielle Harris, I believe.
Yes, she was there too. Ted White, Kane Hodder, Sean was right next to you.
Yep. It was a good show. Scarefest puts on a great show, I think.
Yep. They do very much so.
And I remember you're a little boy.
I have an older one, and then my youngest one, and then the girl was. I had three kids with me, and that was what really meant a lot to me, because I had my picture with you, And then you called them up, even though you had like this enormous line, almost to the point where I was feeling guilty because I felt like I was taking up too much time. But and like I've always told everybody that you are like the absolute sweetest person of any convention of any guest I've ever met.
And they believe you?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. So many people that they say, oh, yeah, they agree with me and they say the same thing.
You know what it is? I look back and I try to keep everything moving. But I figure anybody who's waiting online, I want to give every single person their time. And I think once the person gets up to speak with me, they understand that and appreciate that. And so perhaps they might feel a little like, what's going on? How come we're not moving faster? But I think once they get their time, I think everybody understands, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, I go to a lot of conventions, and there's guests that, you know, that you come up to their table and you feel like you're just being hoarded through to, you know, to get their money to, you know, sign it, and they want to get you through as fast as possible. But it's definitely not like that. You take your time and make sure that everybody has, you know, an experience with you. And I think that really comes through. And the other thing that I've always told people that have never met you when I talk to others is that, you know, a lot of actors, they have their pictures, but those posters that you bring to the conventions to sign, if I didn't already have a poster that I was working on, I mean, that is like one of the best that I've seen for guests to bring their own material to have signed. It's really cool.
I really try hard to make it a special experience because I know if I was waiting online and I really cared about someone, I'd want it to be something that I could hold in my memory as something worthwhile and something that didn't disappoint and something you could, you know, just really put together with the experience with the movie. And I give what I get. I always say that if I have the best fans in in the genre, I just have the best fans, period. You know, I call you guys my happy campers because it's more than fans. It's, you know, we've all been through something together and we share, and I think it's really an incredible thing for me to have you guys, and I want you to know I appreciate you just as much as you appreciate me. So it's like I said, I give what I get, and I just value each and every person that's there for me.
And that's what's so shocking to me, that when you told me that you remembered me from Horror Hound last year, when you came in, you were asking where you needed to go and introduced yourself. And I was kind of like, of course I know you're Adrienne King. Are you kidding me? But when you told me that you actually remembered me out of, you know, probably God knows how many people you meet at these conventions, that really resonated.
I do remember most people I've met. You know, like I said, I do an imprint because you're important to me too. And I think that's what everyone wants to feel, that, you know, that they make a little bit of a difference. And I know I feel that way, and I'm very appreciative. So I thank all of you as well.
Thank you Absolutely. So much. That is so sweet. I mean, the Friday the 13th alumnus have been so amazing. I mean, is it like a little Friday Illuminati that you guys have to be sweet?
Conventions, I suppose, but it's not like we don't all live in the same area, so we have to get together on conventions, and you know, it's always a wonderful thing. I love spending time with Amy Steele or with Ari or, you know, anybody from the Friday. It's like you say, we are all so damn appreciative. You know, we really do care, and I just think it's a wonderful thing when you go to a convention and you're looking forward to it, and you're not like some people looking at getting out of there, you know. And I personally can't do that many of them because it does take so much energy out of me. I can't do them like some people can, but I do try and get to every place I haven't been. You know what I'm saying? It's like my bucket list to hit each area or each place that invites me to a special event that I haven't been to, because there's so many people out there that are campers and happy campers and that have been with this franchise since the start. And then we picked up a few new ones on the way, you know, but it's, we all go back. I think that's the wonderful thing about Friday the 13th and like alumnus is that basically all our fans are alumnus too, because I truly believe it's like a camp situation.
Well, so, let me ask you this. How was it that you came to be cast for part one?
Well, it's a bit of a story, but I'll try and get it as, concise as possible. I was an actress since I can remember. My mom was really bored as a housewife, and we lived outside of New York City. So after a few months of everybody going, oh, put her in commercials, she did. My dad was in advertising. It was kind of a no-brainer. And then my brother and sister came along. They weren't interested, so I actually got the bug early. And when I was 8 years old, I did a Hallmark Hall of Fame, and I really knew I wanted to be an actress. It was Inherit the Wind. And at 8 years old, I just had clarity. This is what I wanted to do. I got such fulfillment out of it. And I worked with, if you go on my website, you'll see an incredible cast of people back then in the 60s, like, you know, the top echelon of actors and producers, directors. And so I just made it my business to get my mom, you know, to drag me into the city until I could do it on my own. And I did all through high school. I had a resume by the time I graduated. I went to New York. I went to Fashion Institute, FIT in New York City for fine arts. I was accepted because I wanted to be in New York City as an actress. And the only way I could convince my parents was to have a fine arts degree or an arts degree of some sort. And that ended up turning into fashion, buying, and merchandising because they were convinced I couldn't be a starving artist and a starving actress. But hey, you know, I managed to actually do that. but eventually, so by the time I was, you know, out of college, I was already doing dancing. I was doing all my lessons in New York City. I ended up finishing FIT at night and working during the day as extras on soap operas and doing commercials, you name it. If there was an audition and it was remotely possible that I could get it, because I didn't have a theatrical agent, I had a commercial agent. And I was working all the time in commercials, and to break into films from that is kind of tough. You have to really get out there and do a lot of extra work and get to know people and build your resume. And then you get day player jobs, and then you get a little bit, you know, you'll get an under five role. And that's basically what I did. But when Friday the 13th was auditioning in 1979, I still could not get an agent to submit me. I was still freelancing. And so I went on an open call, which is where anybody can show up. Basically. And so there were hundreds of people on this open call, and it was sometime in July, right after July 4th, I'm kind of remembering, at the Minskoff Rehearsal Studios on 43rd and Broadway, and everybody and their brother and sister were on this audition. And that's the concise version. So, yeah, I auditioned, and they called me back, and I auditioned again, and I read for every, you know, for all the roles, and then they had me read with all the guys to see who was going to pair with who. So at no point did I know who I was playing up until I screen tested, and that was probably mid-August. So this had already been going on for a month, if you can imagine that. It was pretty intense, and, you know, I got to know Sean and Steve, and Victor was at the, Victor Miller was at the auditions. And, I did a screen test, and Sean, and it involved, you know, makeup and hair and a little bit of wardrobe. And, there were about five or six people actually in the room, and Sean's on the other side of the camera, and he's, like giving me directions to, you know, just, okay, someone's in the bushes, they're about to attack you, react. And I was screaming, you know, and people down the hall were probably running down to see if I was all right. And I got the phone call about 2 hours later that I was Alice. And so that's how it was. And it was exactly, by the way, the Tuesday coming up after Labor Day that we started filming in 1979.
That's awesome.
Oh, wow.
After Labor Day, they picked us up. They picked up Kevin and me and Janine Taylor and Nettie. God, I'm blanking on his name. Poor Nettie. I never remember Nettie's. Never remember. Okay. Sending it out to you guys. Nettie's name. What's Nettie's name?
Mark Nelson.
Yeah.
Oh, got it.
God, we are nerds.
All right. So Mark Nelson was, and we, you know, we drove up that morning, and then we were at camp, and we started filming that afternoon. Crazy. Nice.
Well, so speaking of Kevin Bacon, one of our
here comes a tweet, Kevin.
One of our listeners wanted to know if you had much interaction with him and what were your impressions of him.
What's not to be impressed about? My impression was impressed. Kevin was wonderful. He was just, first of all, just beautiful to look at. And, you know, I, as an artist, strictly as an artist, of course, he had beautiful cheekbones. But, no, he was a wonderful guy, very down to earth. And I love to tell the story about a memory I had sitting up on the lifeguard stand during setting up for the beach scene. And Harry Crosby and Mark Nelson and Kevin were all doing push-ups to buff up for the scene, which just cracked me up, you know. and they were seriously buffing up for the beach scene. And I don't know, I just giggled to myself. You know, I just thought it was just so adorable. And I was sketching, and I had some pretty sketches of some pretty men doing push-ups on the beach. Yeah, we had a good time together. You know, we only spent about a week together, and it was just pure, absolute fun. It was what you see on screen. You know, it was a bunch of kids just out of college, just having a good time at camp.
That looked like fun.
Getting killed.
Yes.
Yeah.
So speaking of sketching, the scene where you've got a hammer and you're hammering away at a gutter. You've got a sketch of Steve Christie. Now, did you actually sketch that yourself?
No, I did not. The art director did, and she and I have very similar styles. So, no, she made sure her art got on camera, which is cool. I would have done the same thing if I was the art director on the film. But it's interesting because our styles are slightly, you know, not dissimilar. So a lot of talent on the set.
Awesome.
Yeah. Did you see that someone did a Facebook post of Alice's roofing services? And they.
No, I didn't see that.
No,
that's awesome.
I love it. Picture of me sucking nails, you know. And I, of course, responded, "Don't hire these people."
So, talking about that scene, there seems to be some unresolved, how should we say, sexual tension between your character and Steve Christie. Is that something that that Victor Miller intended to explore more, or was it just that one scene?
You know, the script is what you call thin. Thin in terms of no real backstory, no real, you know, you kind of have to fill in the spaces yourself, which is one thing I loved working with Betsy. I won't go there right now, but she was all about backstory. But having studied with some of the best people myself, I kind of knew about this before I got to set. And so while I was reading the script and doing homework on it, in my mind, I filled in the spaces that I had spent the night before just having beers with him. He's, if you want to hear my backstory on him, he was my parents and his parents were friends back in California, whatever. I broke up with my boyfriend. He was cheating on me. And this guy, the beer drinking guy, he said, "Yeah, send her over. I have an opening, you know, as an arts counselor, and if she can help with stuff around, send her." So I get a bus ticket, take the Greyhound all the way across country. And this guy's like, I remember when I was a little kid, but I didn't remember him all grown up, and he's kind of lecherous. And so I didn't want to have to go all the way back home on the Greyhound. So I decided that I'd play nice. And so the night before, he was getting a couple of beers too many, and he was getting a little sloppy and a little gross. And But he passed out before anything happened. He didn't even try a kiss. He tried to get close. You know what I'm saying? Just like, if you need, you just stick by me. If you have anything, I'll watch out for you. And he put his arm around me, but that was a little too much for me. So there was sexual tension on his and on mine. It's like, please don't. I didn't want to lose the job, and I didn't want to have to go home on the Greyhound. So you get it.
Absolutely.
Just let's get through the summer, please. And that actually had a lot to do with when Bill Cosby. And I haven't even been buying today, okay? When Harry Crosby, a.k.a. Bill, says to me, are you going to be okay all summer? And I said, I don't even know if I'm going to last all week. It had to do with the night before in my brain.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's all those little things, So it wasn't right there in the script, but you fill in the empty spaces, which is what's the coolest thing that an actress gets to do, if the director agrees with you and allows you to do it. He thought it was a great idea, Sean. I thought it was fabulous.
It played great on screen.
Yeah, he's a go-for
it. Yes, it did.
Slimy individual. Go for it.
So I'm curious, outside of your portrayal of Alice, which is one of my favorite in the whole series. You worked with two other of my favorite characters in the series, one of them being Betsy Palmer, who of course is Pamela Voorhees, and the other one being Walt Gorney, or good old Crazy Ralph.
What's that you say?
Goody Camp Blood, ain't you? You'll never come back again.
I was curious, honestly, like just seeing how their characters are so extreme as far as their mannerisms in the movie. How is that? How are they comparatively as like just who they are? Just, Walt and Betsy.
They were both brilliant. Well, Walt was a brilliant character actor, without a doubt. He just stood there and didn't have to open his mouth, and you just got him. He was just brilliant. And he was a quiet man off set, Actors, generally speaking, are quiet and save it for when they need it. And Betsy, God love her, my favorite person in the world, and I miss her desperately. We became very good friends once we reconnected doing conventions. Oh, goodness, it's over 10 years ago it was when we first got back together. I can't say enough about the woman. She changed my life. She gave me the most incredible teacher. She gave me everything I needed as a partner in terms of a scene to work off of and inspire me. And like I said, you think my backstory has something. She had chapters on every person that affected her and how she got the ring and, oh, please. I mean, she was just a phenomenal actress on and off the screen. She was just the nicest person you'd ever want to meet. And anyone who has met her would testify to that.
So how did it feel to have Betsy Palmer actually smack you in the face?
Well, it hurt like hell. And what was wonderful about it is she never held back at all. And she taught me, if you want to survive, you don't hold back either. And I always say she brought my game up. When you're playing with a better team, you always do better, don't you? Well, hopefully you didn't play.
You don't get better by playing lesser competition.
Ain't that the truth? And she just brought out my best game, and God love her. We finally got to see the movie together, sitting side by side in 08 in Chicago at the Music Box Theater. and we were in the last row, and she kept on grabbing my leg and going, "Oh, good work, honey, good work. It still holds up. It still holds up." And she was so proud of her. She loved the scene of, you know, where before she slept. Was that before or after she slept me? Oh, God. it's so hard to remember that first slap. But anyway, she just loved the fact that when she said, when I watched those scenes between us, she said she still got chills up her arm. And, you know, to hear that from someone who I respect as one of the best in the industry. I mean, you look at her resume. Anybody who doesn't know her, check out her IMDb sometime. I mean,
Impressive.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It's very impressive and lengthy.
This is my first real acting gig, starring in a film. I mean, I've been working as an actress forever, but to get that, to be put with someone of her caliber, is such a gift. And that's why, truly, the movie still lives on, is the casting. Besides the story and the fabulous music and the fabulous directing and all the other goodies, it was the casting of Barry Moss and Julie Hughes at TCI, who just knew everybody in the business and got everybody in there and really gave Sean everything he needed and was looking for. And Sean will tell you that too.
I mean, absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, definitively, I mean, you could say before Friday, you know, in 78, Halloween came out, but in 79-80, you were the second final girl of a slasher film, basically. And yeah. So you built the mold. And how does that feel to know that you set the mold, that the good girl, that even while playing strip Monopoly, has her clothes on? And I'm and
she was chill enough to be smoking pot.
I mean,
it's pretty amazing now. Looking, you know, phenomenal, all of those words, right? It's hard to believe, is what it is, looking back 35 years, 36 years, that we are still talking about it, that this is how we are spending our Friday night, you know? Or should I not say our Friday night? Are we spending our Friday night together, guys, or what night is it?
This would be Friday night?
Yeah. Anyway, every night this is that we're spending together, it's because we all fell in love with a little movie that almost ran out of money before it was finished. You know, it's pretty fabulously phenomenal.
Yes, it is.
Oh, yeah. So speaking of that, I mean, like, could you guys tell after you wrap the movie that there were any hints of this being, you know, sort of the cult classic it's become?
I don't think so. I think everybody was just seriously praying that they'd finish and have enough money to finish it in post, which is, as any director knows, any independent director knows, is something you have to think about ahead of time, you know, and actually have a budget for. And they were still, you know, trying to get their money together, but they did. They finished it, and I got invited to one of the first screenings before they sold it to distributors. And it was then when I saw what they put together and heard Harry Manfredini's music, that made all the difference in the world. Then I got to see the magic of Tom Savini, you know, the magic, the bloody brilliance of Tom Savini. I saw it on the set. He was so kind and so giving and so wonderfully insane to share all of his magic with me. And it's not until you actually see it on screen that you have the uber appreciation that he deserves, because CGI can't hold a candle to Tom Savini. You know,
agreed.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh yeah, there's definitely a lack of practical effects these days in Hollywood. Luckily, we have people like Guillermo del Toro trying to bring it back. But yeah, you're right.
And Gregory Nicotero.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I you know, I'm their fan for sure, because I think it's lost in translation otherwise. And it's not what horror fans want to see. You know, they want to see the artistry, I think, of the special, the real deal.
No doubt about that.
Oh, yeah.
I went to the screening then, and I'm thinking it might have been March. Because it was brutally cold, New York City, and we went to Magno Screening, which is a little screening place that everyone knows in New York. And there were, I didn't know who they were, of course, there were a couple of distributors standing in the back. And my mom happened to be in the city that day, or perhaps I had asked ahead of time, and he said, "Sure, bring her." And I said, "What the heck?" And so we sat in the, you know, in the front, and they all sat in the back. And as I was watching it, I just really, there's just no doubt in my mind that there was something special going on in the screen. And when it came to Strip Monopoly, of course, my mother is holding her breath and lets have it after that. And then at the end of when, after the whole, what I call my director's notes, the machete scene on the beach. I call that the ballet of the machete. after that, my mother felt like the movie was over, you know, like everyone else. She was lulled into this lovely sense of everything's okay and we can go home now without Mrs. Voorhees. And she starts to reach for her coat. And I'm just like tapping her on the lap going to, and
wait for it.
Yeah, just wait. And so, of course, she's like sitting there and oh, my God. At that point, I always say I found out where I genetically got my scream genes. My mother let out this huge scream, jumped out of her seat. I turn around. And Sean has this huge in hands with distributors in the back, and later come to find that Paramount and Warner's were in the same room the same day, and that's why they split the worldwide rights with domestic rights, because they both wanted it. How do you like that being fought over? So wow. That's when we kind of knew, and then Frank Mancuso from Paramount, head of distribution, did something that had been unheard of before that and released it over 3,000 theaters in May, I think it was 9th or whatever, 1980. It had never been done before. And it was this huge word of mouth, and the line never stopped all summer long.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Speaking of the Strip Monopoly, I've noticed at a couple of the conventions that I've seen you at that people actually bring up Monopoly boards to have you sign them. How often is?
Yes, I'm definitely seeing more Monopoly boards. They've become quite the collectible. Especially, I believe they told me it was the 1964 edition. If anybody's looking, but you would probably know that better really? Than me.
Well, we have a Monopoly collector on the show. Our host here.
Yeah, well, I don't collect normal Monopoly games. I collect all the like the Star Wars and all the. Well, I used to. I don't anymore.
We need to add one to your collection.
Yeah.
They need to make a Friday Monopoly. I think that would be great
Someone already is on my Facebook page. I don't know if he's doing it as a you know, just something on the side, or if he's being serious about it, but I certainly think there's enough people in the world that enough happy campers that would enjoy a Friday the 13th board.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
oh, yeah, I would.
Honestly,
I would
you put Friday the 13th on anything, it's going to sell.
Oh, you mean like a wine label?
Yeah.
Oh, and actually, that is a perfect segue into.
You like that?
Probably,
love it.
That is a perfect segue into my next question that I want to ask you about. So, you know, as a fellow wine lover, I'm pretty partial to Shiraz.
Oh, Shiraz.
Oh, yeah. I'm curious as to how you got into the business of being a vintner.
Well, I would love to tell you that. So, number one, I'm a xenophile. You know, I have been. My parents were the kind of people that allowed the kids to drink good wine at special occasions, and so was my husband's family. And so we were both wine lovers. And I like to say, quote-unquote, retired to Southern Oregon wine country 10 years ago. Now, I say retired because that was the plan, right? I have never been busier in my life, and I'm loving every single second. So what happened was we moved up here, and what you get to do if you're lucky as a wine lover is you get to go to all those different vineyards and wineries in your valley. And there are quite a few here. There are over 39 now. There were only 13 when we got here. That's in 10 years. So we're like Sunset Magazine outed our area as the new Napa Sonoma at half the price because we have no sales tax in Oregon. Awesome. And we can ship anywhere except New Hampshire. Go figure. It's crazy, but it's true. So I, Richard and I went to all of them, and we decided on Valley View Winery, which is a few miles from where we live, consistently had the best reds and the best yummy whites, and oh my goodness, just loved their tasting room, and they loved the family because everything out of there, it was family-owned run. The winemaker was a graduate of UC Davis, which is the Harvard of wine schools. So I would have my art hanging in different like little exhibits up here, and they got to see it, and I just thought they were a fan of my art. And then one day they divulged when we were there picking up our wine that they were also a big 80s horror fan, and especially a Friday fan, and would I like to join their family. Yeah, so how do you say no to that? Although I had to clarify what that actually meant. Did I have to give blood or anything? So but no, I just had to, we just, they wanted me to run their tasting room because they knew I had a good handle on the wines, and I could handle the art exhibits there. And what happened was I eventually took over the place like everything else I do. You know how it goes. And, and truly what happened was the family just, we're so loving and giving, and we decided at one point to see if there was an audience for Crystal Lake wines. You know, who would know?
Of course.
I said, the easiest way to try this is throw it out on Facebook, which we did. So we made a Crystal Lake Wines by Adrian King page, and it blew out their website that day. So.
Oh. Wow.
Oh, yeah. We were actually trying to have everybody have a bottle tonight to drink while we were talking to you, but we couldn't make it happen at last minute.
Now, perhaps when you're actually, you know, airing the show, you can kick back.
Oh, there you go.
Potentially so. I couldn't
get... cut out that part and just, you know, kick back.
I couldn't get everybody to tell me what wine they like because there's, you have, you, I mean, from sweet to dry.
I have quite a few now. Yeah. What happened? They gave. We started with a simple Chardonnay and a simple Cabernet Sauvignon, but you see, I have too much fun. I really do, and now I know why I graduated in marketing from FIT. You know, as an A student, because I just love playing. You know, with I love the art. I play with the artwork, my labels, and then I listen to the fans and. I started getting ideas for a third varietal when the first two were accepted so well. We've never spent a penny on advertising, not a penny in marketing, strictly word of mouth. Nothing comes out of the winery unless it's a gold medal winner. I mean, seriously, all they have, the people there who I partnered with, all they have is, you know, their name. And so it's pride of ownership of and pride of what they send out into the world. And so I'm so proud, and I had come up with a name called Survivor Syrah, which everybody went crazy over, and so I did a little color change in Alice's Canoe on the label, and then what did we have? Oh, we had a Camp Blush, which sold out. Everybody's still waiting to come back, but the, you know, you can't rush the grapes, so we're waiting on on our Camp Blush varietals to come around. Then I've got the... Midnight Merlot. And my latest one is, I have a brand new painting, which everyone's loving. It's called Chiller. And it's, it was so hot this summer here that I had to paint something chilly. You know what I mean? And it was for a crisp white, but a little semi-sweet because the people who love Camp Blush wanted something a little sweet. So Chiller has six varietals of whites that are all so fabulous. And, I just been beside myself at the fun and the passion I have for the entire scenario because it came to me with no effort. I mean, it came to me, if you can understand how cool that is.
So I would be remiss if I didn't mention this, but one of our brother shows on the Tangent Bound Network, the host of The Hateful Dead, which is a Walking Dead podcast, and I think they're going to be talking about Ash versus the Evil Dead. Sparkle City Phil, he wanted me to mention this specifically, and like I said, I'd be remiss if I didn't. But he thinks that you guys should start carrying meads. What do you think about that?
Well, I honestly don't think we can do those. You know, gotta work with what you got.
I don't think anybody should be able to drink them. They're so sweet.
Oh, I can't. If he enjoys it, that's his deal. But you know, I don't fault anyone for their taste.
Clearly, you've never had Vikings blood, Eric.
No,
that is not that. That is not that sweet, and it will knock you on your ass. I promise.
Oh no! I at my age, I really try to avoid doing that at all costs. Really, picture.
Well, I do have one other question, though, and it relates to Alice's coming back into part two.
I thought you were going to say Alice coming back as Mrs. Voorhees in the new one.
Well, that, Eric mentioned something about that.
Yes, I think that's an amazing idea.
I kind of would love to do it. Betsy had always said if anyone did it, she wanted me to do it. But I haven't heard a peep from anyone. So I tend to doubt. I don't know why. I mean, Lord knows the campers would like it, I think.
Oh, yeah. That would be an excellent way to incorporate you into the new one. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, somebody, I was watching because somebody posted something today on my page, a writer, about the reason you should be excited for the new Friday the 13th. And that's what people were writing. Oh, is the agent going to play Mrs. Voorhees? And it's like, that's a nice idea, but somebody has to actually think of it.
I did read a story. Is it true that there's a project with you and like Amy Steele and some other final girls getting together to do a movie called Survivors or something like that?
That was in development. The one that's really happening, though, that I start shooting in a little while is called William Frost. And I just got some really exciting news. Oh, do you want that? Because that would be like really interesting news.
Absolutely. You heard it here first.
Absolutely.
So let me tell you and your listeners first, playing Jackie Winters, investigative reporter, in the new film called William Frost, which, if you haven't heard about it, it has a horror genre cast that everyone will enjoy, and it's really frightening as hell. The script is, and an up-and-coming director, Natalie Bidley, is just, I saw some of the things she's done recently. She's fabulous, and she just called right before, we're just going to have to tape this because I don't know who's calling me, but it's going to do it again. Hold on. Goodbye. Goodbye. And so Natalie just called me, and she told me that they're including a scene with Kane Hodder and me. So
outstanding.
Friday fans will really enjoy that. And I'm glad that I get an opportunity to work with Kane on screen. It'll be my second Jason.
He's a great guy.
Jason, in the second movie, when you were asking me about Alice in the second movie, the ice pick in the face was delivered by a still-in stunt person, not a Jason,
right.
Not an actor.
Okay.
So I actually have a second Jason in the second movie.
Because
it's all a nightmare anyway, right?
Well, that's what I was telling the guys, and they were like, no, it can't have been a nightmare because you see Alice's body in the shack at the end and all that stuff.
You think so. But what did he do?
That is too much coincidence right there.
I've seen a still shot of the scene, and the ice pick is still in the corpse's head. So, and there's a robe around it, just like, it's hard to say that wasn't Alice.
All right, but how did he walk through town with Alice over his shoulder, really.
That is good.
Hey, how did he come back to life in part six? We'll never know.
She's the Lady of the Lake. She brought him back just like the Lady of the Lake brought Lancelot back. She...
Maybe the movie will give us all the answers.
Well, my question about part two was, is there's been varying different reasons as to why Alice wasn't the star of part two.
Yeah.
I mean, even in Crystal Lake Memories, there was different people said that, she wanted too much money or she was doing something else. I mean, so I thought who better to ask than you, what is the true reason that, you know, you weren't brought back to star in the whole feature of part two?
The true reason is that when I had a meeting with Steve Miner, it was like I remember sitting with him and Denise saying, whatever you guys need me to do, I will do. But that was with knowing that I had a stalker at the time. And I was not focused. You know, you have to understand 1980, after the movie opened, stalking was allowed. It was not a crime. I mean,
right.
That's John Lennon.
Exactly. And, you know, back in the day, things were very, very different. There weren't any cell phones and there weren't, you know, cameras in the hallways and you couldn't catch people. And it was really, I would get Polaroids. I tell this story that I would get Polaroids of what I'd been doing the day before, the night before, underneath my door. And it's very unsettling. And especially seriously. And the authorities would not take it seriously until I actually had someone engage me physically. And that's what had happened eventually. But up until that time, I was on my own, and my managers and agents were not being totally truthful with producers because everyone wanted me to do the film. But I couldn't actually focus enough to do the entire film, if you get what I'm saying. Unfortunately, there was no entourage, and there was, you know, my family is very middle class, and it's not like they could pick up the phone and get, you know, I don't know what you could have gotten back in the day, but, you know, a bodyguard, I suppose, would have been a good idea, except no one thought it was that big a deal until I had a gun to my head, and then people went, oh, yeah. Okay, I guess we should pay attention to this.
And that's something we mentioned in our part two episode, the fact that, you know, when you're watching that intro scene to part two, it really didn't seem like you were acting. You seemed that creeped out about what was going on.
No, it wasn't acting. And quite honestly, I didn't even have a script. I mean, they were so upset with me. And honestly, you know, I don't know who actually said, it hurts me that they say, you know, I wanted too much money. I would have done anything. Are you kidding? You know, who's that stupid to kiss the best role away if you had the opportunity? I also think that they honestly wanted to develop the role of Jason and make Jason the, you know, the monster. You know, it's you don't really need a final girl. You can always get another girl. I mean, seriously, that I'm sure that had a lot to do with it, that they might have thought, and who knows what my agents were asking for at the time, because they bailed on me soon thereafter. After I didn't do it at the second movie, I lost them. So Lord only knows what they were asking for, but it had nothing to do with what I needed. No one really cared. I just needed, you know, a bodyguard, probably, and a good therapist.
Yeah.
But
it's not funny, but you know.
I'll tell you something. Looking back at it now, I wouldn't change anything in the world. Honestly, I'm so proud of part one. Part two did what it needed to do to get to the, you know, the next round, and I'm enjoying the fruits of the Friday the 13th franchise 35 years later. You know, how can I not be?
Absolutely.
You know, I'm very grateful for what Friday's given me, especially you guys. And that's the truth. It's the people that care. That's, you know, that's what I always say fills my heart.
Well, yeah, we are huge, huge fans of you in part mm-hmm. one and even part two. Again, we really appreciate you coming on to talk to us tonight. I know, you know, you're pretty busy, so it's cool that you took the time out of your day to chat with us for a little bit.
Never too busy. That's true. I want you to know that.
And that's awesome, and we really appreciate it.
All right, guys. Till our next Friday the 13th, and I'll see you back at camp.
All right. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to the show at. If you want to support the show financially, head over to campbloodpodcast.com/donate. Send your questions and theories to our Facebook page or tweet at Camp Blood Pod. You can also send an email to feedback@campbloodpodcast.com. We also have a phone number that you can text or leave a voicemail, and that's at 757-637-0216. And also, please consider checking out some of the other shows on the Tangent Bound Network, like the network's flagship show, The Tangent Bound Podcast, The Night Keep, or The Hateful Dead. You can find these shows and many, many more at tangentboundnetwork.com. Our intro and outro music was graciously provided to us by the Downriver Rat. Check out his music at thedownriverrat.com.